for the first time in their history, they're confined to a reservation. You know, before they, the government, in the more they had contact with whites, I think probably the more whites tried to control their world. But once they were on the reservation, a confined piece of land that was about 200 square miles in northeast Kansas, then things got more difficult for the Iowa. For the first time, the government had more control over their daily lives. And then also for the first time, Christian missionaries had more control over their daily lives. So it was a real turning point for them. And the book that I wrote really just kind of examines the first 25 or 30 years of life for the Iowas on that new reservation and dealing with that new mix of circumstances.
Previous to that, they had been throughout Missouri right. and southern Iowa?
Right. Actually started in the Great Lakes up around Green Bay, Maya Shuje, they call that, Red Earth. And in their story, that's where they came from. And then they migrated over time down through Minnesota and into Iowa, Iowa. And they lived along the Des Moines River, the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, really all over the state. It was not a straight route from north to south. And then by the time Lewis and Clark came, you know, they're living in southern Iowa and soon after into northern Missouri. And that got to be a problem because in 1824, Missouri becomes a state and they want to extinguish all the native rights to their state. And so in 1824, the Iowa signed their first ever land treaty, giving up land to the United States. And then they were, at that point, moved to around St. Joseph, Missouri, in a little slice of land that was not yet part of Missouri. And then in 1836, Missouri decided they wanted that land, so they signed treaties with a number of tribes that were living there at the time. And as a result of that, the Iowas were forced to cross the river into what's now Kansas. Kansas and Nebraska didn't exist at the time, so what's kind of interesting is the border even today, or rather the reservation today, spans the border of Kansas and Nebraska because the Iowas were there first, and then when they ran that border on the 40th parallel, they ran it right through the reservation. In fact, there's a cemetery on the reservation. Half of it's in Iowa, or half of it, I'm sorry, half of it is in Kansas and half of it's in Nebraska.
Tell me about the role of the Great Nemaha Sub-Agency.
That was the name of the, well, it's basically a government designation. It became known as, you know, the Iowa Reservation, and then next to it was the Sac and Fox Reservation, but the agency was named after a river that goes just north of the reservation, but the agency was the government entity then that had daily control over the Iowas and the Sac and Fox.
How successful was the sub-agency at their stated mission, which was preparing the Iowas to enter mainstream American society?
Well, initially not very successful. And part of that was their own fault because government agents got their jobs because they had political patrons. And so, in fact, I'm just now doing some work where one of the agents that they had after this book takes place was very tied to Jim Lane, the senator here. And so because of that, it was just rife with graft and all kinds of political shenanigans. So it really, an interesting result of that was I think that the Presbyterians who had a mission on the reservation ended up having a lot more control because you're having a new government agent come in sometimes every 18 months, and there was a period of 18 months where there was no agent at the agency just because of politics and very much tied into what was going on in Washington at the time. Whoever might be in the White House had an effect on who was manning the agency. So as a result, the Presbyterian missionaries had a lot more control because they were there for the entire time.
Greg, I'd like to read a quote from your book, Iowa Life. When nearly 1,000 Iowas and 500 Sacs and Fox moved in the spring of 1837, it was immediately apparent that while the government had been eager to push the natives out of Missouri, it had done nothing to prepare for their arrival in Kansas.
Right. They were eager to get them out so that Missouri could have that land, but they made no preparations whatsoever on the Kansas side of the river. So the Iowas and the Sac and Foxes were really interested in getting over early in 1837 because they wanted to plant a crop. So they got over there, and there was no survey had ever been done of the reservations. And so the deal was is that the Iowas were going to get 200 square miles, and the Sac and Fox were going to get 200 square miles. But no one ever told them where to settle. So there's a river called the Wolf River, and the Iowas just, they thought that was a nice place to settle because they had access to water, and the bottom land right there was really great for farming. So the Iowas just settled on one side and the Sac and Fox on the other, and the two tribes got along by that time pretty well. So there was, you know, they worked it out between themselves. So when the surveyor came then, he had to devise a reservation boundaries that followed that, and he ended up with an oddly shaped reservation that years later, when the Iowas and the Sac and Foxes had to give up major parts of that, the surveyors were still cursing the original surveyor because he had to run this circuitous route around the villages and then make it all work out so the land was evenly split.
Let's jump ahead to 1854. The Kansas-Nebraska Act is passed by Congress. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the effect that has on the Iowas who are then living in Kansas.
Right, in what was then Kansas or Kansas Territory. And yeah, immediately, Kansas has an interesting land history, and it took me a long time not being from Kansas to sort of sort that out, and I'm still not sure I have it right. But you know, with preemption laws and squatters associations and things like that, there was a lot of pressure on the U.S. government. You know, a lot of whites wanted that land, and they wanted the native people gone completely. And in fact, a lot of the nations that were up there were forced out completely, but four of them were able to hang on. But because hunger, you know, white settler hunger was so strong for that land, all the tribes that lived up there, the Iowas, the Sac and Foxes, the Kickapoos, and the Potawatomis all gave up major parts of the small reservations they had to begin with. So today, they're just little dots on the map, really, compared to what they had originally.
One of the stories that you tell in your book, Iowa Life, is the sad story of poor Lucy.
Yeah, that's a project. I found that story when I was working on another project about a folklorist from St. Joseph. And then it was confirmed to me by a tribal elder who said that when he grew up, he heard stories of white settlers taking native children to work as basically domestic servants. One of the odd things that kind of a coincidence of history is that the Oregon Trail ended up going right through the middle of both reservations. And so it created a real conflict of cultures that happened more quickly than it would have otherwise, because suddenly the Iowas have, I mean, thousands of wagons going right through the middle of their settlement, and these people are leaving trash, they're cutting wood, you know, their cattle are eating up all of the grass and forage, and then to top it off, children were being kidnapped. We have no way of knowing how often this happened, but the fact that Mary Alicia Owen in the 1920s wrote a story about poor Lucy being taken to California with a family, basically to, you know, work for the family, taking care of the kids, and then the fact that this elder in the 2000s told, you know, said that as a child, he'd heard similar stories. And what happened to poor Lucy is she went with a family out to California, and the family was going to strike it rich in the gold fields. And of course, as so often happened, they didn't strike it rich. And so the family came back defeated. And when they got to the reservation, they dropped poor Lucy off where they found her. But of course, several years had intervened in between. Lucy was older, and her family was nowhere to be found, and she didn't know whether they had died or maybe they'd moved. You know, a lot had happened in those years. So it is a sad story, and apparently, even though it's folklore, there is some basis of truth, we think, to it.
Talk to me about White Cloud and the careful line he walked between Native Americans and the white people.
Yeah. White Cloud, Francis White Cloud, and just that's an interesting thing right there, his name, because his name carries both his, you know, the fact that his father would have been known as simply White Cloud. Mahuthka is the Iowa word for that, and he was a revered leader. And then Francis White Cloud, already you have the fact that he carries a Christian name and an Iowa name, and that's a great symbol for the fact that the way he had to live his life. He wanted to be like his father. His father was an assimilationist and thought that really they had no choice but to go along with what the whites wanted, because the whites had the power, in his view, to kill them. But Frank had really bad, you know, he resented, I guess is the word. He resented the way his people had been treated. And as much as he wanted to do what his father had told him to do and follow along with what the whites wanted, his heart just wouldn't let him do it. And then he, to make matters worse, he found his role in the tribe diminished because the government agents became more powerful and took over a lot of the roles that the chiefs would have had originally. So in the end, Frank really struggled to try and maintain his leadership to the point where he launched an ill-advised ambush, basically, on some Potawatomis up in Nebraska. And among the few that were killed were a Potawatomi girl and a Potawatomi child and a woman. And, of course, that was the end of Frank's leadership role. And then, of course, there's the whole story of the Iowas going to Europe with George Catlin's show, basically, kind of an early version of a Wild West show. And Frank White Cloud thought that it would be, Catlin had invited them. What happened is George Catlin took about 500 portraits that he had painted of Native Americans with him to Europe, and P.T. Barnum backed him in a show that they were sure would make a lot of money. And in the beginning, Catlin would show these paintings in a hall that he would rent, and then he and some of his family and friends would dress up in Native clothing, and they would explain, they would do a little show and tell about Native life. And of course, in Europe, people just loved that.
Just to be clear, we're talking about two white people dressing up.
Right. Catlin and his son, I think, that were. So, yeah, because they had collected a lot of clothing over the years. And at a certain point, then it occurred to someone in the show that, hey, this would be a lot neater if we could get some real Native people to show instead of Catlin and his redheaded son.
That seems pretty obvious.
Yeah. So, and because Catlin had traveled widely in the West, he had a lot of connections. He'd met Iowas in the 1830s and knew Francis White Cloud's father. So first some Ojibwe's came over, and they were there for a year or so, and that business relationship soured for whatever reason. So Catlin invited some Iowas to come over, and because he knew Frank White Cloud, Frank was sort of the head of the trip, and he got to choose 14 people to go with him, 14 Iowas. And what's interesting, White Cloud thought that if he went, he could bring some publicity to the plight of the Iowas. You know, they were poor, they needed money, they needed food. They were really in a bad way. And so he thought that this would be a good trip, a good way to bring attention to the problems they had. What to me is really fascinating about it is once they got to Europe, they were actually encouraged to do a lot of the things for show that they were discouraged from doing in the United States. So they could wear their traditional clothing, they could sing their traditional songs, they could do their dances for the benefit of Europeans, and back home they were discouraged from doing any of that. And of course, the sad part of this story is that they didn't make any money. They came back poor, and in fact, a couple of missionaries, the only thing they gained on that trip was a trunk full of Bibles, and a couple of missionaries came back to join with the Presbyterians. So it didn't work out as well as Frank had hoped it would, and he never really did gain the leadership that he really, by tradition, deserved.
Greg, how did you become interested in this story?
That's kind of hard to say. I'm from Iowa. I grew up in Northwest Iowa, and going through public school, I never quite latched onto the idea that there was an Iowa people. There were Iowas around somewhere. And we were always told that it was what Iowa meant, beautiful land or something like
that.
That's
what I always heard.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really only, I was in Oskaloosa, Iowa, doing another research trip on a sculptor, and there's a beautiful statue of White Cloud Mahaska in the courthouse square there. And it was done by an Iowa sculptor named Sherry Edmondson Fry. And I read the plaque, and it said, Mahaska, friend of the white man. And I'd never heard of Mahaska. And furthermore, I was really kind of vague on the fact that there were even an Iowa people. So I got back and started researching, wanted to find out who this guy was. And there, I figured somewhere there'd just be a book about him, but there wasn't. And so I wrote an article and just got interested in these people. And I think one of the things that really fascinates me about them is that I'm not Iowa and I'm not native, but they are sort of geographical ancestors to me, because it turns out that they had lived in a lot of the same places I've lived in. They'd lived in northwest Iowa. I live in Missouri now, and they'd lived at a certain point not too far from where I live now. So that bond has kind of kept me going, and I've just been sort of following them through history and writing what I find.
In doing the research for this book, what's the most surprising thing you learned about the tribe or their treatment?
Well, I think that initially when I started this, I had to kind of face a lot of the misinformation and the biases I had. And I always was under the impression that American Indian people were defeated or decimated, or however you want to say that, by military force. You know, you always see these movies, these westerns about the Indian Wars, which are, you know, the most popular part of the conflict, you know. But really, that was just, that happened after the Civil War. Mostly the thing that was surprising to me, and that I'm still sort of trying to sort out in my work, is that the warfare that settlers inflicted on Native people was cultural. It was changing the economy that natives had to deal with. It was changing the religion that they wanted the natives to experience, changing the education, changing the way. They didn't want native people to farm communally anymore. They wanted them each to have their own 60 acres and live on their own farm and change farming methods. So to me, the most surprising thing is that the warfare, the Indian Wars, were really more cultural than they were military.